Finding your perfect home was hard, but thanks to Burrow, furnishing it has never been easier. Burrow's easy-to-assemble modular sofas and sectionals are made from premium, durable materials, including stain and scratch-resistant fabrics. So they're not just comfortable and stylish, they're built to last. Plus, every single Burrow order ships free right to your door. Right now, get 15% off your first order at burrow.com/ACAST. That's 15% off at burrow.com/ACAST.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Okay, I have two new obsessions that I need to share with you. Impress No Glue Press-On Manis and Impress Press-On Falsies Lashes. Trust me, these are getting ready game changers. Both require no glue, so there is no damage to your natural nails and lashes, no mess, and no annoying dry times. Just one step and you're done. Boom. Instant glam. Visit impressbeauty.com/presson and use code PRESSON25 at checkout for 25% off Impress manicure and Press-On falsies.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Humans Vs Manchester with me, Clint Boone. Every week we'll be celebrating the spirit of Manchester by talking to somebody who's helped shape the city. This week I'm joined by Mancunian legend Steve Adge Atherton, tour manager for the Stone Roses, the Coral and the Seahorses. He talks about the first time he met Ian Brown and heard the Stone Roses music.
And out of this room one night, just came this noise, just so angry, so fast, but so, so good. And then Ian come out one film, went, oh, hiya. The music that came out of that thing was so fast and so furious and so angry. And I just went, wow, that's what I want. That's what I want to be doing.
And he tells us about how it felt as the band were rising to legendary status.
I'll tell you what, they had no doubt whatsoever how big they were going to be. It was just an accepted thing that we're going to do this, I'm going to do that, then we're going to do that, and we're going to do that, and it was just going to go forward.
It's a great pleasure to welcome to the studio a man who spent many years of his life playing an integral part in the rise of a band who pretty much changed the course of the British music history as we know it, often described as the fifth Stone Rose, Mr. Stephen Atherton, a.k.a. Adge. Welcome, how are you?
Hey, Clint, nice to see you. I don't know about the fifth Stone Rose, I work with the band, about that. I was very close to them all the time, yeah.
I've seen somebody call you the fifth Stone Rose, so I love that.
Oh, there you go.
But there was Cressa as well. Cressa probably thought he was the fifth Stone Rose, didn't he?
Cressa was a far more integral part than I was. I couldn't dance like he could then.
Yeah, he had some moves,
but I could drive.
Definitely. Well, that was the key to it, wasn't it? As we will come to, you had a van and you could drive just when four young lads from Manchester needed it. Yeah. Let's come to that in a minute. First of all, Adge, where were you born and when were you born?
I was, my name's Steve Adge Atherton. Everyone calls me Adge. I was born 12th of the 5th, 1957, at 63 Barber Street, Manchester, just off the old Gorton Road, with a tin bath on the wall outside till Sundays, outside toilet, and an old bomb site outside as a playground, but with the 60s on the way. Mods, punks, pills, acid, football. Manchester was my all in all when I was a kid.
It sounds like happy days already.
It was happy days. It was rough and ready, but you didn't know any better, did you?
I can totally. I was 2 years younger than you, but same thing, outside toilets, lived in a corner shop. Times were hard, but we didn't know it. We felt loved, we felt warm, you know what I mean?
Exactly. I can remember being a kid and people getting up to work in very early hours of the morning. The whole city was black and white then. The buildings were black, you know. There's no. They were technicolour today, aren't we? But I can remember we had gas lamps on the street, and we used to have the poles at the top and where you'd swing on them. They would look like, they used to hang there, just hang there overnight. You look out the window, quite spooky, like so many Pierpont gallows, like up and down the street, rainy, think of it. And then my dad's got to go to work in the morning, but we've got no alarm clock. And the bloke used to walk around, this trench-coated bloke, with this long pole, and he'd put out the gas, turn out the gas lamps in the morning. But then he'd also, as a sideline for sixpence a week, turn his stick over and knock on the window to wake people up. Can you imagine, right, being living in the slums of Manchester then? You're about five. The one you go to bed, they used to go, "You've been swinging on them lampposts, haven't you, again at night, yeah? The knocker-upper is coming to get you in the morning." So you used to go to bed, and you'd be never go outside to the bog at night. We used to have a potty then, do you know what I mean? Because in case the knocker-upper was going to get you. And then I saw him one day, and he just pointed, because he must have been in on the game, and he used to point at you like with like a crooked finger. Probably just a bloke from the shop up the road. But that's one of my memories of, God, don't go out. If you want to win at night, get in the knocker-upper is lighting all the lights up. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? And now they've all gone, the gas lamps, obviously, in Manchester. You know that there's still 2,000 in London. They've still kept theirs. Well, there's 1,998 now, because a bin truck knocked two down near Westminster about 2 months ago. But there is still, that's why it's lit like that in Westminster. It's old-fashioned gas light, which they've kept. 1,998, two have gone. I don't know where they are. Wouldn't mind one in my front garden, and knocker-upper can come around whenever he wants. But that's one of my early memories.
What did your parents do for a living?
My dad worked at AEI on Trafford Park, he was a tool maker for turbines for engines, and he worked at Mankem, which is where City's training ground is now. He worked with phosphorus then, things like that. My mum worked as a machinist from home, as they all did. They used to bring sewing machines into your front room, and then they'd drop off a load of bit of denim, and then you'd see your mum, who's looking after the kids at the same time and getting the dinner on and all that. Stitching up jeans, and then at the end of the week they'd come and pick them up, and they get paid, well, pro rata really, I suppose. So mum was always at home, and but only a two up, two down. Don't know where they are. I've no idea where everybody slept. I've no idea. I can't remember it now. Kids were born there. I remember our mate being born there. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And it was a very small place, but the whole, it's one of those, you've got about 55 aunties or uncles on the street. It's one of those close-knit communities. Borwell Street's still there, one side of it with a Friendship pub on it. There's a little green hill where I was born. I think it's some sort of monument.
A symbol.
A symbol, yeah, things to go.
Was it a Catholic upbringing?
No. I think I'm a Protestant, but my grandmother's name is Berthoff, which I'm sure is Jewish. And I grew up with a lot of my friends from school were from the Moravian movement out on the old Ashton Road up there, which was, you know, the old settlement, like a war town. Peaky Blinders, they filmed Peaky Blinders in it. Yep. That's a beautiful old period thing that the city of Manchester gave to this people that needed somewhere to live. So a lot of my mates were there. Some of my first mates at school in Borwell Street were from the old Brookhouse flat, which is the very bottom of Gaunton Lane. It's now gone and knocked down to, like a tenement. And they were all Indians and Pakistanis, so all my mates at school, some of them would wear skirts, you know, and talk in really strange languages. So I grew up in that sort of environment from a word go.
And like you said, playing in bomb craters, I remember that, because when growing up in Oldham through the 60s, there were still bomb craters in the Second World War, and there were a lot of fun.
When I was a plumber years ago, before the Roses, I used to stand on the top of buildings and I'd just watch rats running from spare bit of ground to spare bit of ground, because he'd left the cellars open. Yeah. And just filled the rest of it, you know, knocked it all down, carted it off. And now look at it. No, look at the city, brilliant.
How early in your life did music stick its nose in?
As I say, I'm the second born, so I'm 61 now, 62 next year. My brother, God rest his soul, is dead now. He was the first bloke I ever saw in leather pants, you know, before any rock band. I used to think, what's he up to? And he was really into his rock stuff then. And then all of a sudden, there was this massive change. When they knocked the estates down, I was 11. We moved up to Attersley. He was just, he used to go missing on a Friday and he'd come back like Sunday afternoon, like into Northern Soul. So that was the thing that took over our playlist in the house, really, to be truthful with you. I used to look at him, I used to watch them, they'd come back wide-eyed. They had that proper wanderlust that Fermin knocked about with. He'd come home with mad tunes of what filled the dance floor and what trouble they'd been up to. And then later on, he was into it for so long. Later on, when I got my first car, they used to nick it on a Friday and bring it back on a Sunday. Yeah. But it was that first got me into it. And I couldn't wait to sort of have my own little slice of that, my own little slice of Manc music, you know. And then times changed. And as soon as I was old enough, I moved back from Attersley to the city.
And what were the first records that you got?
My first record, you're going to laugh. You're going to laugh. My first record, I've got it. I've got it at home now. It's Tommy Steele little white ball, and it was off brilliant. My auntie.
I loved it when it came out.
It's a top. So I've got it on. It's on a little stand in the house. It's the first tune I ever bought.
Yeah.
First band. But then in difference, first band that I went to see was Queen at the Apollo.
Wow.
And that was by pure mistake. But all, it was just went. I remember he had black fingernail polish, Freddie Mercury. That's all I can remember about the gig.
How did you do at school? Were you a good kid?
I was a lot better than my elder brother. He was a naughty boy. And because of that, I think my only criminal record is streaking in the late 70s when it was in vogue. That's my only thing. I always put it on all my visa applications. I was caught in Ajax United football. I ran away from the police for about 45 minutes. It would have been the deep still.
Right.
But I wasn't a naughty boy at school. I was in the gang, obviously, which because that's protection. I was only little, but my gob, as you can tell, kept me safe. I moved to that school the day that the school opened. It was the first day this school opened, and it was like I'd come up from. I knew nobody on the estate. I moved up in the summer, walked into this school, and it was just a war zone. It was four different areas of an estate that had all come from different inner city parts. And we're sorting out who was cock, and I wasn't bothered who was cock. I just knew didn't want to get involved with that. It was a right firm. I left. I was the last year you could leave at the age of 15, and luckily enough, Manchester Corporation were taking on twice as many apprentices that year. So as I was leaving school, one of them said to me, "Atherton, thanks for letting me try." And he said, "What are you going to do now?" I went, "Oh, I've got a job as an apprentice plumber at the Direct Works." And it was just purely by my gob. I got in there and just got it. And then I was a plumber until I was 20, 25, something like that.
Let's just backtrack a minute before we go on about your first job there. You use the phrase cock for our international listeners that might not know what that means. The cock of the school. You don't hear it anymore. The cock of the school was the big boy, wasn't he?
Or the big girl. We had a girl at our place as well that would knock anybody out. But basically the cock of the school was the one that, if they wanted to take a bit of your butty off you at lunchtime, yeah. They did or whatever. But if you were clever, you could get them on your side with your gob as well. You didn't have to fight them because some of them are monsters, you know.
Which has subtitles for these international listeners. Gob equals mouth.
I'm very sorry.
It's good. It's brilliant. And if we're talking about cock of the school, like now it's got a completely different connotation.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's good. Well, thank God you cleared that up.
Let's talk about the first job then. So you're back, you're out in the real world, you're getting your first wage. Tell us about that job.
A shock to the system is all I'll say. I can remember you get your brand new overalls on, you've got your tools that the corporation have bought for you, and you're going to pay it back at so much a week. I got put onto Mount Road Gorton modernisation, and I was quite bad. I could never score a goal at football, but I could run really quick up the wing. And I was adopted onto the plumbers and joiners football team at Manchester Gorton modernisation, Mount Road there, rough area. There's some stories there that one of the blokes took an instant dislike to me. He was called Tony, and he was a massive, big Irish labourer. And every time I used to run at the wing, I used to blitz past him, and he just dropped me with his hobnail boots. But I used to shout in his ear and wind him up. And then one day they paired me off with him, working with him. He's like shouting it, "Come on now, smash the bath, get the bath, smash it out, no, smash it out," shouting at me. Mm. I mean, I had this big pick in my hand, and instead of smashing the pick in the middle of the bath, I threw it with my skinny arms. It bounced off the enamel, and the end of the pick buried into his kneecap for like 3 inches. Wow. And he just lay on the floor striking like a kid shouting, he hit me with the pick.
Let's talk about the first time you met the young men that became the Stone Roses.
The first one I met was Ian. I was out at the old Manchester Poly, where Hatch is now, on where the flyover goes over. That building there, the Nelson Mandela building, as everyone was in the city, I should imagine.
Right. Yeah.
And I was in there. Well, you said I was a naughty boy at school, but no, I was a naughty boy after. You know, I didn't mind fighting at clubs, I didn't mind fighting at football. Mm-hmm. And we had a right firm with us always. But I met Ian there, and then after my period of being a plumber, I was in a band, I was rubbish. I'm not even mentioning, you don't even go down the route of what band it was, I'm not telling you, they were rubbish, right?
Would I remember the name of it?
No, I don't.
Because I was on the scene at that time, I knew.
I've no idea what you're talking about.
Come on, tell me.
Absolutely no idea. Sure. I don't even know where you're going from. Anyway, the fact that the band was so bad, I got the job as studio manager at Spirit that was run by Johnny Brakel then, which has turned into the School of Sound Recording before it moved out just under the Mancunian Way there, going up to the Apollo. And we had every band you could think of in there, and the Noises, the Membranes, all Carmel were in there back in the day, James were in there. But then out of this room one night just came this noise, just so angry, so fast, but so, so good. And then Ian come out, walked through, went, "Oh, hiya." The music that came out of that thing was so fast and so furious and so angry. And I just went, wow, that's what I want to be doing.
Yeah.
So I started by just making sure that the stuff was all right, getting to the room okay, and helping down the stairs with anything. That's all I've ever done, really, help people down the stairs with stuff, to be truthful with you. I had a driving licence, and when they wanted to go and do things, I said, well, I'll take you down there, no problem. And it just sort of built, and you had to hit the ground running with the roses.
Yeah.
But you don't work for the roses, you work with them. That's what's different with them. Them and the Coral are very much the same. From our Scouse friends, they were my other band for about the next 15 years after the Roses' first breakup.
So that was day one, minute one, was you seeing Ian Brown walk out of that rehearsal room in Spirit. From there, the bond with the band carried on pretty much to recent times. Tell us about some more of those early days, because the Roses were really good at putting on these iconic events, like the warehouse party. Yeah. And
it was strange to go from a warehouse party where we had no license, we had no venue, we had no PA, we had no bar, we had no power, to one that crisscrossed the globe with screens the size of streets, do you know what I mean, and everything catered for. Mm. And I must say, I enjoyed both sides of it. I enjoyed the really early battling against the police. I've never been big on authority, me. Someone telling me to go home at 1:30, I'm not having it. I'll do what I want to do. And that goes back to my brother's Northern Soul thing, I think. And when the Roses wanted to do something different, and we said, well, we'll have a go at it. I went on the Enterprise Allowance and set up a record label called Blackmail Records. There's no danger of any record coming out. We just put it on so that when we put these gigs on, we would be filming a live gig of the first band on Blackmail Records. We had no letter paper. We just cut it out of the Manchester Evening News like a ransom note, Blackmail Records, but then photocopied it on a Xerox machine, and then just went to the British Rail Properties, said, I want a railway arch. And they went, well, where's your company? Just showed them this bit of paper. They went, yeah, you can have one. And we got that. We went and got a stage, and we got a PA. So we put the band on, and they didn't even want to start till 3 o'clock in the morning, which was when all the clubs were kicking out. The police were stretched to the limit all over the city. And Fairfield Street, where the taxis are now, it's Piccadilly train station, that run down to Temperance Street, that was the back end of Piccadilly. So it was out of the way. So that's where we thought we were away from any trouble. But after they'd sorted the clubs out, I can remember, as everyone came into the building and paid the £2 to get in, I think we gave them a piece of paper with film extra written on, a penny sellotape to it. And we didn't tell anyone where it was either, because it was the Roses, it was called the Warehouse Pie, but it was called the Flower Show.
The Flower Show,
we put it in the gardening section of Manchester Evening News on the Friday, and that's when people turned up, got them all in. And when the police arrived at 4:30 in the morning, the band were in full flare. And there were amphetamines used on all sides, I'm sure, crowd, everybody. It was a very fast event. I was off my mind personally, I know that for a fact. And my brother knocked me on. I think they were playing something like So Young or something like that. And my brother tapped me and showed me about the old biller outside of the race, strong, you better go out. And I walked outside, and there was a line of about 10 cars. I noticed a load of long sight diamonds on the floor where someone's car had been hammered. You know, the window's gone in. And I walked up to this copper, and he just looked, he'd seen a lot more alive than I've ever seen. And I tapped on the window with my clipboard, and I went, good evening, officer, how can I help you? Pushing my eyeballs back in my sockets. And he looked at me and he went, all right, kid, disperse this now and get everyone home. And I went, excuse me, officer, my name's Stephen Atherton, and this is Blackmail Records. It's an official Blackmail video shoot. And he went, I don't care who you are, mate, get off of there. I went, officer, should you stop this proceedings now? And I just pulled out the bottom of the public liability. And I went, I will sue you for that amount of noughts, and showed him the £1 million. And he went, hang on a minute. And his radio crackled, and a train rolled across the top, and thumped a bit of diesel in the air, smelt a bit of diesel. He said, it's a video company, this. And they come back and went, right, okay, bring everyone back to base and tell him to let us know if they're ever doing another one. And off they went. So I walked back in, we finished off a top night with it going berserk. But the next morning, they'd left two coppers driving around the car. And as we finished, we'd brushed up the area that we were in, put all the stuff in the van. And just as I was about to go, got the takings from the bar and a load of cans left in the back of the van. And this cop car with two young coppers pulled up next to me. And they wound the window down. And I looked at it, I thought, oh no, here we go. Turned around and looked at them, and they went, hey mate, how did it go? When's it going to be on Top of the Pops? So they were just kids like we were kids, you know what I mean? But in a different gang uniform, basically. Yeah.
But this was before warehouse parties were a thing. I mean, these days, you know.
18 months before raves.
Yeah, before raves, before the warehouse project, and years before. So it's quite an unusual thing to do at the time. One of my standout memories of the Roses back then, you'd go and see them gigs like Legends in Warrington, I think was one of them, somewhere in Preston I went to. And it wouldn't
Preston
be
Clouds.
Yeah, that was on. And Ian, it wouldn't be unusual for Ian to walk off the stage with the mic into the crowd and get right in some guy's face.
That's what I used to stand in the crowd as well, not being told to do by the band. And you know, he'd be walking in the crowd and he'd walk up to people and think, oh my God. And if anyone heckled him, there'd be like 30 of us that have gone from Manchester. We just wade into him. But you would always back him up like that. I remember going to McGonagall's in Ireland. and we were booked into a heavy rock club, and the band were going through this period where they had beautiful shirts that John had made. We walked in just before they were going on stage, and the dressing room was like a cloakroom where you keep all the cleaning stuff next to the stage. Lads had all the shirts on. I looked inside and they were dancing at Thin Lizzy. And I went, we are going to die here. And we had to literally break broom handles up to fight our way out. It was terrible. But they went and did them sort of gigs. I was the getaway driver on the paint throwing thing, all that later on in life, you know. And I went, what are we doing? And if anything ever went in their way, they would work a way around it. That, you know, the videos, I can't remember which video it's for, but it was like there's a bit where they're just all moving really slowly. Mm. It's all in slow, and that's because that's the only footage they had. And they just slowed it down to the length of the record. This is very clever.
Unpredictable and always fearless as well. Going back to Ian, the way he always had that beautiful little face and features, and he'd just be scared of now. And to this day, he's just scared of nothing, is he? He eventually got signed. He went down to London to make that iconic first album. Did you realise at the time they were making history?
I'll tell you what, they had no doubt whatsoever how big they were going to be. And it was like, it was just an accepted thing that we're going to do this, I'm going to do that, then we're going to do that, and we're going to do that, and it was just going to go forward. Mm. I didn't see it, no. I just was enjoying it. If you're in the eye of the storm sort of thing, you just get on it, don't you? Just a party. Still managed to bring up three kids, and they've all managed to bring up kids, but we parted our way around Europe and then around the world.
What are your fondest memories of that era then, the standout moments?
Loads. There's loads from the early periods of time where it was just fun. We'd go to Ireland. What they'd do, the roses, they'd make it so that you'd go to a gig, but then you'd have fun around it. Do you know what I mean? You go to Ireland, so we went to the Giant's Causeway. I've never been to the Giant's Causeway since. We stayed in bed and breakfasts. We had no money. You know, it was very low budget to do things. And I'd go and ask the lady, I said, if we give you a tenner, can I just use the kitchen and make beans on toast for everyone in the morning? And that sort of early stuff like that, daft stuff, is the things that I've found. We went to Norwich and that's where Easter, who did the sound for the roses, that's where he learned to be a potter. I can remember being woken up by John Squire with his hands covering slip going, Ads, you're a plumber, how do you fire up a kiln? And I'm just leaping up going, what are you doing? And they're in an adult education centre where we're staying as just in the rooms, and they've just gone and turned everything on, and they were all making pots and all that. Things like that, the things that make me laugh, all that sort of stuff.
Potheads.
Potheads, exactly.
We're at Spike Island, what are your memories of that?
Easy day for me. Absolute doddle. I blew up my biggest thing for that, I blew up the globe that Ian, that's what, probably had a load of weed in it because I used to smoke in those days.
That's the globe of the world, a big ball, big inflatable ball of the world.
And he just said, what shall I do with this? I went, just hold it in your hand and it'll be in the papers next week. Stone Roses have the world in the palm of their hand, and it did. You know what I mean? But I remember the day being dead easy. I remember that helicopter was nothing to do with the band. We went down there in the car as normal, probably a hired car. As we got out to go across the locked around the back of the stage, the band all gave me what tickets they had left, which is a common thing for them. And just went, go and sort the youth out around. And I just go around the front, there's loads of kids trying to break in. I just went, from the band, dished out. And that's what they do always. And that's what they were good at, making that connection with fans. You know what I mean? It wasn't this and that. That's why Ian could walk in the crowd.
Men of the people, innit? Mm. So that chapter ended and the band went off then to work on the next album. And then not much happened for the next few years. Behind the scenes, and bearing in mind, obviously, you've got an ongoing loyalty to the boys, what was your perception of what happened next?
Why was there the gap? The gap was the legal issue, a lot of it. The band couldn't record in those days. They weren't allowed to because there was legal stuff, because they were suing Gareth and Gareth was suing them. Yeah. I spent 6 months in an accountant's looking at boring things that I never wanted to do in my life. While the band were trying to write and get on everywhere they went, people to know where, wanted to know where they were. So it was all about getting them to places where they could work without people minding them, really. I enjoyed that period of time because I was able to find places for them to rehearse, find places for them to record. It's a great job when someone says to you, there's your budget, do that. No mobiles, not quite yet. You know,
no social media to worry about.
None of that. I can't do social media anyway. If you want to know where I am, ring someone else up, they'll tell you. I've not had a phone for a year. It's been brilliant.
So eventually the album did come out, the second coming, but by 96 it all fell apart again, didn't it?
I was so proud of that album. I was so proud of the work that they did on that album. They went through hell and high water on that. There's a lot of blood on that album right across, which I'll tell eventually. But not between the band. We all went through our issues. Everyone goes through your issues, don't they?
Yeah.
But they still created. I mean, people slated that album, but I thought it was belting. They'd signed to Geffen, then Geffen sold off Geffen Records, and then that record label sold off to somebody else. Every week there was a new letterhead in as people were buying up different companies. So they were in a state of flux, basically.
Yeah.
And when they've been given the time, when they've been given the free rein to handle their own history, their own future, after what gone on in history, all right, you're going to piss up the wall a little bit sometimes. Mm. But they still put out a cracking album, and the work ethic was there. They didn't fall out as much as people say they fell out at all. They were just doing their own thing.
Yeah.
They were, you know, you're allowed to do your own thing with the Stone Roses, and that's it. You're all grown men. But in the meantime, I was going out when we were in Monmouth doing Second Coming, making it up as they were going along, a lot of it, which worked as well to a certain extent, but very expensive.
Mm.
I was going out and the band said to me, have you seen anything else? I went, yeah, they're called Oasis, mate, and they're coming like a train.
Back to the Roses, and that first chapter ended in 1996, and then 15 years later,
yep,
it all started again, didn't it? We got the news that they were getting back together, 3 big gigs at Eaton Park. I know how important that weekend was to me. I took my kids had to see it, went 2 nights. How important was that for you? How beautiful was it for you when they got back together on that stage?
I tell you what, after all the shenanigans that went on with them, they were due that stage. They were due. It all went wrong the first time. They were due that size of stage.
They were due that payday, weren't they?
They were definitely due that payday. So there's nothing without the four on the stage.
Yeah.
Don't care how many lights you put up or anything. They were owed that. They were owed it.
Yeah.
But the beauty of it was, as everyone says that there was a big gap between the first album and Second Coming, the beauty of it was they worked hard to make that show what it was. That Saturday night at Eaton Park was absolutely colossal. Mm. Absolutely colossal. But where I was working for Moran anyway at SGM Concerts after the Roses split up. He put me on the Coral. I was with the Coral 15 years. Sure. My other love, the Coral are my other love.
Yeah. Right.
Beautiful, beautiful people. Same gang mentality.
Same spirit.
Funny. Yeah. And, you know, very, very creative. So they'd obviously still be working, but Moran went, well, the Roses are going out. And I went, right, great. And he went, will you go on it? I went, of course we will. But I had very little to do, to be truthful with it. The beauty for the tour after Eaton Park for me was, before they went on stage, there was just me and them in a room before they went on.
Yeah.
So I like little things that they do when they do the warm-ups and all that. It's really nice bit to witness. And then they go out. The start of that film, Made of Stone, where Ian's walking along they've not been on a stage that for many a year with the band that he wanted behind him, and he's just walking, slapping the people's hands as he goes through and taking phones off him and filming it.
Yeah.
It was a class act.
Yeah.
You know, it must have put everyone right. And it was just needed to be done. And then to see it all unfold right across the globe was cracking.
You mentioned SGM. They're like Manchester-based concert promoters, one of the biggest in the UK, if not the world. And Simon Moran and SGM is a beautiful machine to work with, isn't it? So compared with the ramshackle bunch of people that you used to have, you know, yeah, with all respect to Matthew and Gareth, the original management, and this was just where the Stone Roses needed to be.
Well, Simon Moran put the gigs on at the old Warrington Wolves at Legends. The first time we met him, my middle son and my daughter, Josh and Maddie, their mother worked for Simon just down the road here. When it was a smaller office, when he was getting on his feet. But when the first time we met him, Roses were sound checking at Legends in Warrington, and he came in and said, can you keep the noise down with the drums for a bit because you're making the snooker balls bounce on the table upstairs? And Rennie said, you booked a pop band now, you booked a rock band here, you have to put up with it. And he went, you're quite right. And from that moment, I thought, he's right, bang on him.
For those people who are listening who've never had the pleasure of meeting the Roses, give us a little brief, a few words on each of them.
Manny is like Tigger. Just like, you know, he was my constant drinking partner. John, unbelievably creative, unbelievably kind, you know, unbelievably artistic. So I was allowed to work on his art as well, just driving it about again, just a driving license. John's helped me out so much in my life, honestly. Ian, as you know, charismatic, funny, sharp as a pin. Rennie, just the same, but in a different way. They've all got the voices that they pull off each other, the way they can imitate people, they all had that force, which when there was four of them together like that. Their music was a soundtrack to the early part of my life, and I can pick where I was when things happened, do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And remember funny things, but also sad things that happened at the time. They were a gang, weren't they? Just like the Mondays were a gang. I think you all were a gang, isn't it?
That's what bands are, isn't it?
Yeah.
Good bands.
Good bands are a gang. Yeah, they are, definitely. as a group of people, I loved them all anyway, but individually, they all brought something to the table.
You've mentioned a couple of times lifestyle stuff, chemicals I'm talking about, which you enjoyed, not just through the Roses period, but before that it started. But in recent years, it caught up with you, didn't it, a bit?
Oh, God, yeah. God bless the NHS. That's all I'll say, Wivenshaw Hospital. Bands can stop partying when they go off, but if you go off with another band, you party again. And eventually, the things that you take come back to bite you on the ass or in the leg. And I had to, after I'd finished the 2012 thing, I went to work at V the next year and I couldn't walk up the ramp after the end of the weekend. And it was just like, you know, like lacto acid building up in your muscles. It felt like that. So I went to the hospital the next day and this, I couldn't walk up the corridor. I literally couldn't walk up the corridor. And this Swiss doctor just waved me over and wrote on the back of an envelope, go to Wythenshaw Hospital now, just give them that open envelope. It's written on the back, I'll try and save your leg. Mm. I meant, what? And what had happened was my arteries had blocked up right down the right-hand side of my leg. Not with the stuff that you're taking, but with the stuff that it's cut with just floats through your bloodstream and all goes south for the winter.
Follows the gravity, doesn't it?
Yeah, gravity takes place, mate. Everything's getting out of Cornwall, but not a lot of it's using the M5. Do you know what I mean? Your blood's getting there, but eventually. So I went into the hospital and he just matter-of-factly walked in, the surgeon, Dr. Ghosh, God bless you, sir, and he just drew with a pen on my leg from my hip to just above my ankle. I went, I'm going to cut you here. I'm going to take a load of veins. I'm going to wrap them. I'm going to make them into an artery. I'm going to protect that artery out. I'm going to plug this one in. And I'm a plumber by trade, as I know, so I know about piping. And I went, where are you getting the piping from? Then he went, oh, you've got loads of spares in your leg. If someone tells me don't do that, I'm going to do it. If you're going to take it, if someone says to you, this is going to happen to you later down the line, you just go, yeah, right, I'm young. I don't care what you say, I'm doing it anyway. People are going to do what they're going to do. They've done it, you know, they've done it since we had beer, since we've had everything. When I went in hospital, they went, we've been waiting for your lot. We've been waiting for your lot to come. Yeah, the next wave of Alzheimer's, the next wave. And I was like, oh, what are you talking about? Can't remember what they're talking about then. Yeah. They were just really informative. They're ready for what we're, the mental illness from skunk and things like that. They're ready for it. Mm. Don't know how they're going to deal with it, the money that they're on. But they saved my leg. I'll tell you what, saved my leg and they've saved my ability to walk.
As you said, God bless our NHS.
God bless the NHS.
Let's talk about Manchester, the Manchester spirit, which is the main thing that these podcasts are all about. What do you feel about the Manchester spirit?
I'll tell you what, I love this town. I love this town, I do. I've been almost, I've not been to South America, but I've been everywhere else in the world. And there is, I don't know whether it's the rain that drives them underground, it's the worker bees, it's the industrial, why has so much happened here? Why is so, it is a hive of activity. Mm. When you used to go to London in the early days, London needs biscuits, as foxes used to say. You get on the tram there, on the underground, they don't look at each other. Everyone just puts their head down. Here, it's like, I've walked down the street today, I could hear five different languages. And everyone's like, all right, mate, you're all right, mate. A lot of them are buried in the phones nowadays, fair enough. Yeah. But, you know, looking where they're walking. But the actual city is a friendly place. It's, you know, we've got football, obviously. Every city's got that. And we've got it where it kicks off every now and again. But I've only ever had to run anywhere proper to get away from serious trouble. And once was in Manchester and once was in LA. So that puts us on a par with West Hollywood, I think. But they're madder because they all think they should be in the movie industry. But this city, people say that this city was built on the profits of canals, cotton, steam and coal. And I'll have that big time. Mm. But nowadays, when you look at the way the city's growing, it's also built on acid house, northern soul and rock and roll in my heart. There should be blue plaques all over this city where music, as it's the lifeblood of the city centre, I think. From the clubs, I don't know how they're all staying in business, don't know how that all works, because we seem to be coming up from everywhere when we had nothing back in the day. Do you know what I mean? Nothing. The fact that it has bounced on from the deprivation of the... I mean, I loved it when it was a dump. You know, I mean, don't get me wrong, I loved it when it was a dump, because you used to go and do what you wanted to do, and it was a bit mad. But now I look at it, and it's like, look at the people that are coming in. People don't come here for canals, cotton, steam and coal. They come here for acid house, northern soul and rock and roll. And that's our new entertainment industry, and it's our new tourist thing, I think. Yeah. Apart from the history that we've got within the building, Peterloo Massacre and all, I've got really into that over the last few years, really looking into all the history of the city. And you walk up the canals and you're looking. I walked up towards Canal Street the other day, we were going somewhere, and on the just back off Princess Street, I just saw this massive building. I went, what's that? There, I've never walked along the canal there, coming up towards the new union. And we went and had a look literally down the down the back to see what this building was. Thought it must be an old mill, must be all this. It's the power station that does the city centre.
Yeah.
Never even knew it existed. So you find out new things. Jutland Street, I love. I love Jutland Street. I love where Hatch is down there. I love the what they're going to do at the Mayfield Centre,
yeah. Yeah.
Because that's where the warehouse parties were. So that development is growing now. So I see the change. They're going to put a walkway in it with trees and all that. So I love the fact that it's constantly evolving. I don't mind the fact that it's going up in the air for profit. They must do it right because the sight lines coming in from Liverpool or from Sheffield or from our side of, you know, either in Wally Range, from our side of the city. The dominant buildings are right on your side. I love that.
Cityscape.
Cityscape it is. But I know they've got to get a load of money back for what they're pumping up in the air.
Yeah.
But you also see it on a ground side where it starts to swell out. Grubb's the other one I'm thinking of.
Grubb, yeah.
Opposite the train station. And the White Hotel over the Salford side where people are just taking over old garages and putting the pit where you change your oil is the bar.
Yeah.
Open till 6:30 in the morning. Why couldn't that when I was a kid?
Yeah.
Why couldn't I have done that? We had to do it all illegally. And I think the fact that we paved the way for things like that
absolutely
makes it possible now.
One of the things I've learnt this week about Manchester, I didn't know. You know, saurine malt bread?
Malt bread, yeah.
That's been made here forever.
Yeah, of course.
I didn't even know that.
No, I've got so many Manx, including Damien, badly sketched bloke, badly drawn boy, right? He said, where are you going? I said, I'm going to the Vimto bottle. He went, what are you talking about? And I love the history of the temperance movement and sarsaparilla and Vimto and things like that and Dandelion and Burdock, because they wanted you to go home after you'd been out and had a drink. You couldn't drink beer. They wanted you home, up, working in the mills.
Yeah.
So we had the temperance movement, quite absolutely had the temperance bar in the Hacienda, it all ties together. But I love all that. I love that history of the town and the suffragette things. You know, and the computer. It's just everything. The trains, everything, mate. Where I was born was close to Gorton Tank, which is where the trains were made.
Yeah.
And that's where loads of people went. And it was black. It was just a black, sooty environment. Everything was black, 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 black. But it was great. I loved it then.
It's like an endless list of monumental moments in time.
Isn't it?
Like the nuclear stuff and the, like you said, the suffragettes and factory records. It's never ended. If we just had one of them in this city,
would die for it, wouldn't they?
Yeah. Before you go, Adj, who are your favourite humans of Manchester, past or present?
I would say for the actual influence of the city, I would say Alan Shorin. I would say Simon Moran from the music side of things. I would say Emily Pankhurst. And I would say Sergio Aguero.
Describe Manchester in three words, Adj.
Never-ending beat.
Steve Adj, thank you for being a human of Excess Manchester.
Oh, it's been an absolute pleasure. I'm going home having chips and gravy.
That was Steve Atherton, a.k.a. Adj. Make sure you join us next week where I'll be speaking to Karina Jadav. She's a Mancunian businesswoman and menagerie restaurant owner. Don't forget to follow us on social media and do subscribe to Humans of Excess Manchester. Rate us and feel free to leave some feedback. We always like to hear from you. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.